Chapter 51, Tunnel of Love. After born in the USA, I'd had enough of the big time for a while and looked forward to something less. Assisted by my engineer, Toby Scott, I'd slowly invested in home recording equipment. Four tracks grew to 8, to 16, to 24, and soon I had a decent demo studio set up in the garage apartment of my Rumson home. I'd recently begun writing some new material that for the first time wasn't centered around the man on the road, but the questions and concerns of the man in the house. Tunnel of Love captured the ambivalence, love, and fear brought on by my new life. Recorded in approximately a 3-week period, cut with just myself on acoustic guitar to a rhythm track, like Nebraska, it was another homemade record, where I played most of the instruments myself. After USA, I wasn't ready for producers, a big band, or any band. The music was too personal, so in the studio it would just be Toby and me. My first full record about men and women in love would be a pretty rough affair. Filled with inner turmoil, I wrote to make sense of my feelings. The beginnings of this new music went back to Stolen Car from the River. That song's character, Drifting Through the Night, is the first to face the angels and devils that will drive him toward his love and keep him from ever reaching her. This was the voice that embodied my own conflicts. I was no longer a kid, and now neither were the people who populated my new songs. If they didn't find a way to ground themselves, the things they needed, life, love, and a home, could and would pass them by, rushing out the windows of all those cars I'd placed them in. The highway had revealed its secrets, and as compelling as they were, I found its freedom and open spaces could become as overpoweringly claustrophobic as my most cliched ideas of domesticity. All those roads, after all those years, when they converged, met down the end of the same dead-end street. I knew. I'd seen it. It's in Texas. I had a left-field hit with Brilliant Disguise, a song that sits thematically at the record's center. Trust is a fragile thing. It requires allowing others to see as much of ourselves as we have the courage to reveal. But Brilliant Disguise postulates that when you drop one mask, you find another behind it, until you begin to doubt your own feelings about who you are. The twin issues of love and identity form the core of Tunnel of Love. But time is Tunnel's unofficial subtext. In this life, and there is only one, you make your choices. You take your stand, and you awaken from the youthful spell of immortality and its eternal present. You walk away from the netherland of adolescence. You name the things beyond your work that will give your life its context, meaning, and the clock starts. You walk now not just at your partner's side, but alongside your own mortal self. You fight to hold on to your newfound blessings while confronting your nihilism, your destructive desire to leave it all in ruins. This struggle to uncover who I was and to reach an uneasy peace with time and death itself is at the heart of Tunnel of Love. Bob Clearmountain cleaned up my playing so I sounded like I knew what I was doing. I brought Nils, Roy, and Patty in to sweeten a track or two. Then Bob did the mixes, adding the sharp spiritual space the music resides in. Tunnel of Love was released on October 9, 1987, and went to number one on the Billboard album chart. I hadn't planned to do any touring, but sitting at home, while a record containing what I felt was some of my best and freshest writing went untended, didn't seem right. I was asking my audience to follow me from Highway's End, out of the car, into the house, and through marriage, commitment, and the mysteries of the heart. Is that rock and roll? A lot of them by now were living these issues every day. Would they want to hear and be entertained by them too? I was rolling the dice that they would, and I wanted to give my music a chance to find its audience. For me, that always meant playing, and so a tour was planned. Tunnel was a solo album, so I wanted to distance the tour from being compared to our USA run. I shifted our stage layout, moving band members out of their long-held positions as a subtle way to signal to the audience that they should expect something different. I added a horn section, brought Patty to the front of the stage and left of center, and designed a carnivalesque proscenium to frame the action and play off my main metaphor of love as a scary amusement park thrill ride. In keeping with Annie Leibovitz's cover photo, we dressed up. The blue jeans and bandana were gone. I wore a suit for the first time in quite a while, and the band left their casual wear at home. My good friend and assistant Terry McGovern donned a bowler hat and tux to perform the role of ticket taker and MC. It was a nice show, with Patty providing a sexy female foil I could play off of, comically and seriously, to underscore the album's themes. We covered Gino Washington's Gino is a Coward, and the Sonics' Have Love Will Travel, and performed my own unreleased song, Part Man, Part Monkey, to flesh out the tour's plotline. After Born in the USA, it was an intentional left turn, and the band was probably somewhat disoriented by it, along with my growing relationship with Patty. Patty was a musician, was close to my age, had seen me on the road in all of my many guises, and viewed me with a knowing eye. She knew I was no white knight, perhaps a dark gray knight at best, and I never felt the need to pretend around her. Julie had never asked me to either, I just did. When Julie was filming on location, I'd be at home in New Jersey, slowly slipping back to my old ways, the bars, the late nights. Nothing serious, just my usual drifting. But it wasn't the married life. It was during one of these periods Patty and I got together under my ostensible excuse of working on our duets. It was a September night, the moon a slim fingernail in the western sky over the silhouetted wood that bordered the backyard. We hung out, sat in my little bar, talked, and pretty soon I could feel something was on. After 17 years of sporadically bumping into each other, then two of working side by side somewhat flirtatiously, there came a moment when I looked at Patty and saw something different, something new. Something I'd missed and hadn't experienced before. I was always busy, as Patty would say, looking in other fields. Patty is a wise, tough, powerful woman, but she's also the soul of fragility, and there was something in that combination that opened up new possibilities in my heart. In my life, Patty is a singularity. So it started. At first I told myself it was just a thing. It wasn't. It was the thing. The surreptitiousness didn't last long, and I came clean to Julie as soon as I knew how serious Patty and I were. But there was no decent or graceful way out of it. I was going to hurt someone I loved, period. Soon I'd be separated and photographed in my tighty-whities with Patty on a balcony in Rome. I dealt with Julie's and my separation abysmally, insisting it remain a private affair. So we released no press statement, causing furor, pain, and scandal when the news leaked out. It made a tough thing more heartbreaking than necessary. I deeply cared for Julianne and her family, and my poor handling of this is something I regret to this day. Julianne was young, just getting her career started, while at 35 I could seem accomplished, reasonably mature, and in control, but inside, I was still emotionally stunted and secretly unavailable. She's a woman of great discretion and decency and always dealt with me and our problems honestly and in good faith. But in the end, we didn't really know. I placed her in a terribly difficult position for a young girl, and I failed her as a husband and partner. We handled the details as civilly and as graciously as possible, divorced and went on about our lives. After our divorce was final, I took a few days and visited my parents, gave them the news, and listened to my mom hector me with, "Bruce, 3 years, your limit." "What?" They loved Julianne, but I was their son. I stayed a while, having my wounds treated with home cooking and sympathy, then headed back to New Jersey. My dad drove me to the airport. 10 minutes out, he turned to me and said, "Bruce, maybe you should move back home for a while." I was tempted to mention that I was a nearly 40-year-old self-made multimillionaire, and the prospect of moving back into an 8-by-12-foot room in my parents' house, still holding my stuffed Mickey Mouse, was not impossible, but not likely. Nevertheless, when I looked over at my pop, his suspended girth squished between the wheel and the driver's seat, all I could say was, "Thanks, Dad. I'll think about it." The old man finally wanted me around the house. 88. 7 years after Steve and I first walked through Checkpoint Charlie, I brought my band back to East Berlin. Steve wasn't there, but 160,000-plus East Germans showed up. The wall still stood, but the first cracks were definitely appearing in its once impregnable facade. Conditions were not what they had been a decade ago. There in an open field stood the largest single crowd I'd ever seen or played to, and from center stage I couldn't see its end. Home-stitched American flags flew in the East German wind. The tickets claimed we were being presented by the Young Communist League and were playing a concert for the Sandinistas. It was news to me. The entire show was broadcast on state television, another surprise, with the exception of my short speech about the wall, which somehow was conveniently deleted. I went from being a complete nobody, sashaying unmolested down the streets of East Berlin on the day before our show, to a national superstar in 24 hours. When I poked my head out of our hotel the day after our gig, I was surrounded by hipsters, grannies, and everything in between vying for an autograph. Ich bin ein Berliner. We partied at the East German consulate and then headed back to West Berlin, and a show for 17,000 that, despite our good West German fans, felt a lot less dramatic than what we'd just experienced. Rock and roll is a music of stakes. The higher they're pushed, the deeper and more thrilling the moment becomes. In East Germany in 1988, the center of the table was loaded down with a winner-take-all bounty that would explode into the liberating destruction of the Berlin Wall by the people of Germany. Around the World in 42 Days. Heading back home, we had the option to continue our Tunnel of Love tour or go to work for Amnesty International, the highly regarded human rights organization. Amnesty was making a concerted push to enlist and engage young people around the globe in the fight for civil liberties, and figured what better way to prick up the ears of the youngsters than rock and roll. Guided by Peter Gabriel, we were enlisted by Amnesty's then-executive director, Jack Healy, and our Tunnel of Love tour morphed directly into Amnesty International's Human Rights Now tour. We shortly found ourselves on a 747 with Peter, Youssou N'Dour, the sensational Senegalese singer, Tracy Chapman, and Sting, international rock stars all, hopping around the world, dropping for a moment from the clouds to tell you how to run your show. I'd always felt rock music was a music of both personal and political liberation, and I thought the tour would give us an opportunity to practice some of what we preached. It did, but in the process I got mugged by schoolwork. Nobody told me I was going to have to study. We had to do a full press conference in every country, and we needed to know in detail the human rights issues in each. Trying not to look like the dilettante I was, I studied like I hadn't since Sister Teresa Mary stood over me, ruler in hand, at St. Rose Grammar School. The audiences were spectacular. The concerts lasted for 8 hours and featured local opening acts. In Zimbabwe, the great Oliver M. Tokutsi tore the house down with African soul. A little over a year from now, Nelson Mandela would be released from prison, and the slow dismantling of the apartheid system would begin to occur. But at this moment in 1988, the battle was raging. The simple mix of a white and black crowd of this size, something that was forbidden and illegal a mere 300 miles south, brought an urgency to our appearance. In the former French colony of Côte d'Ivoire, I was greeted for the first and only time since the 1966 Tri-Sol Review at the Matawan Keyport Rollerdrome by an audience, a stadium audience, of completely black faces. I finally knew how Clarence felt. We were one black man and seven white folk from New Jersey. Was this going to work? Was the wooden-legged, 4-4 beat of Jersey Shore punk and soul going to communicate to an audience used to the swaying and supple rhythms of Afrobeat? Headlining, we were last to go on. A cool sweat slowly formed on the uppermost layer of my skin beneath my black vest and shirt. We went for the nuclear option, kicking straight into Born in the USA. Time crept to a standstill. Then, boom, the place exploded into a frenzy. The crowd moving in mass as if they'd been wired together and had suddenly decided this was okay. It was the most joyful mutual celebration of discovery I'd ever experienced. We were the wrong color, singing in the wrong language, to the wrong beat, and still the crowd shed upon us their generosity, openness, and national hospitality. It was the first audience the E Street Band had had to truly win cold in a long, long time. Women leapt on stage and danced. The crowd rocked in ecstasy, and the band walked off feeling exhilarated and validated. It works. All the way over here, it works. We felt the closeness of old hands being challenged, and in league with this unexpected and willing audience, becoming victorious. The mysteries of music's communicative power to cross great divides proved themselves once more, and we knew we just experienced something special. Somewhere along the way, we played a few dates in the United States where our usually politicized press conferences were peppered by celebrity questions and a vacuousness that sometimes made me embarrassed for the locals. We also stopped in Japan, Budapest, Hungary, Canada, Brazil, and India, and finished up in Argentina, a country of stunning landscapes and a gorgeous, sensual citizenry that made me want to learn Spanish immediately. In South America, where countries that had recently experienced the full brunt of dictatorship and the daily trampling of simple human freedoms, thousands of sons and husbands were disappeared off the streets during the reign of brutal regimes in Argentina and Pinochet's Chile. Here, Amnesty's job was immediate, critical, and personal. It was something hard to push up against and to feel pushing back. With Pinochet still in power, we played on the border of Chile in Mendoza, Argentina. There, the mothers of the disappeared, whose loved ones had vanished from their homes and the streets in the years of Pinochet's dictatorial rule, stood holding placard photos of lost loved ones along the roadside as we drove toward the venue. Their faces were filled with the remnants of terrible things we simply had no clue about or ability to understand back in the USA, and proof of the ongoing human will, desire, and primal need for justice. The Amnesty International tour made me thankful to have been born in the USA, in my little repressed, redneck, reactionary, one fire hydrant crap heap of a hometown that I loved, where despite the social pressure of the ignorant and intolerant, you could walk and speak freely without fear for life and limb, mostly. 6 weeks after we'd started, we'd had our say, boosted Amnesty in its international agenda, played our rock and roll, and stood for a moment, thumbs out, political-cultural hitchhikers at the crossroads of history. Home again. Patty and I said our goodbyes to Peter, Sting, Yusu, Tracy and Amnesty's mighty road crew, whose human rights were consistently violated with long working hours and untenable conditions during the tour, and we returned to New York City. We'd rented an apartment on the East Side, and I gave my one and only try at becoming a city boy. It was a no-go. The East Side wasn't for me, its only redeeming feature being I was just a walk away from Doc Meyer's office, which helped because I was not at my best, I came home torn by the confusion of my divorce, and with no recourse to roads and wheels, the city days were long indeed. In New York City, I was the magic rat in his maze. I couldn't get sky, couldn't see sun, and couldn't run. Yeah, the museums, the restaurants, the shops, but I was still small town. I couldn't change, so Patty, a 19-year New York City resident in Chelsea, capitulated, and we packed up our bags and headed back to Jersey, where she, I, and my ice-cold feet spent a lost summer with me up to some of my old ways and thoughtless behavior. Patty was patient to a point. Adjustment. Back at home, Patty and I fought a lot, which was a good thing. I'd never argued much in most of my other relationships, and it had proved detrimental. Too many issues simmering, unresolved, beneath the surface always proved poisonous. Like my father, I was a passively hostile actor. Denial and intimidation, not direct confrontation, was my style. My dad had controlled our home by quietly sitting there, smoking. He was all passive anger, until he'd break in rage, then return to his beer and monk-like silence. He was our own one-man minefield, filling our home with the deadly quiet of a war zone as we walked on point, waiting for the detonation we knew was coming. We just never knew when. All of this had seeped into my bones and ruined so much. I didn't lose it often, but I could, silently, and just enough to put the fear of God into my loved ones. I'd learned it at the feet of the master. Worse, I picked up his bad habits behind the wheel, and I could be very dangerous. I would use speed and recklessness to communicate my own rage and anger with the sole purpose of terrorizing my rider. It was gross, bullying, violent, and humiliating behavior that filled me with shame afterward. I was always full of 1,000 apologies, but of course it was too little too late, and I suppose I'd learned that too. These incidents occurred only with people I cared about, loved. That was the point. I wanted to kill what loved me, because I couldn't stand being loved. It infuriated and outraged me. Someone having the temerity to love me. Nobody does that, and I'll show you why. It was ugly and a red flag for the poison I had running through my veins, my genes. Part of me was rebelliously proud of my emotionally violent behavior, always cowardly and aimed at the women in my life. There was assertion. There was action. There was no impotence. The passivity of the men I grew up surrounded by frightened and enraged me. My own passivity embarrassed me. So I went in search of my truth. This is how I feel about myself, about you. How I feel, how you make me feel, in my darkest of dark hearts, where I truly reside. Over the years, I had come to the realization that there was a part of me, a significant part, that was capable of great carelessness and emotional cruelty, that sought to reap damage and harvest shame, that wanted to wound and hurt and make sure those who loved me paid for it. It was all straight out of the old man's playbook. My father led us to believe he despised us for loving him, would punish us for it, and he did. It seemed like he could be driven crazy by it, and so could I. When I tasted this part of myself, it made me scared and sick. But still I held it in reserve like a malignant power source I could draw on when psychically threatened, when someone tried to go someplace I simply couldn't tolerate. Closer.